This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoane. We're taking today's show back to my conversations with funny guests who have joined us over the years. We begin with Margaret Cho. The Korean-American comedian began her career at the age of 16 and became a bona fide celebrity by her mid-20s. She joined me 15 years ago at a time when she was rebuilding her status as a premier comic. This was following the cancellation of her ABC sitcom, All American Girl. She has since rebuilt her reputation and continues selling out theaters all over the world. Let's take a listen to a portion of my conversation with Margaret Cho.
Does it feel like a long way from that comedy club above your parents' bookstore in San Francisco?
It does, and it doesn't. You know, it's interesting how much, you know, my career has been such a huge part of my life. You know, I've been working for so long. I almost can't remember when I wasn't a comedian. And, you know, starting back then and then, you know, all the touring and it always brings me back. Like I'm touring now and just driving on I-95 makes me remember all of those times where I was renting cars and driving across the country to play colleges and, you know, which was a big part of how I started and how difficult it was. It's really hard to live out there on the road. And, you know, finally I've learned how to do it. You know, now it's like great, but it was really difficult when I started just, you know, being by yourself and being kind of like this lone Asian American woman traveling across, you know, the country and a car by yourself. It's really like weird. You just see a lot of different things. And I think that really shaped my perspective. You know, I feel like such an outsider sometimes.
A lone Asian woman driving across the country, what happens to you that might not happen to me?
Well, I think that people, you know, tend to stare at me a lot. I mean, maybe just that happens in general. I think I look a little odd anyway, you know. Then certainly traveling to places where, you know, I would eat in restaurants / gas stations and the farmers just didn't know, you know, who I was and why I was there and what that was all about. And so I guess because of that, I always felt like a celebrity even before I was one.
Right.
People were always looking at me you know, now I guess they look at me because they recognize who I am. But before it was just because I was very out of place.
You know, I'm really curious what your early material was when you were 16 years old, again, playing above your parents' bookstore, trying to make your way into the comedy world. What was some of the early stuff you did?
I think I was always really the same. You know, I think I really understood my my comedy and who I was pretty early. You know, I just talked about my family, which I still talk about. Right. I talked about my mother a lot. And my material was really basically the same. Not the same jokes, but the same attitude. And, you know, I guess I was really lucky because I knew that I wanted to be a comedian very young and I knew what I wanted to do very young. And that really gave me an advantage over everybody else.
Were you the sort of stereotypic class clown looking for an audience, or were you like a lot of performers that I've met, especially comedians, rather on the shy side and lived a more sort of separate life than one would normally expect?
I think I was really very separated. I was very isolated and very much an observer. You know, and I think that's what a lot of comedians are, is that we're just very observant and very just stand back and watch. I think the more exhibitionistic ones tend to not be very successful.
Yeah, they kind of burn out
or
need is different.
Yeah, it's more like, you know, a need for attention and a need for some kind of acceptance and some kind of reassurance. And I think that the true comedians are really, you know, it's an internal thing. It's not really a need for anything. It's just something that we create on our own, and it's an art unto itself.
Were you then instantly comfortable performing in front of people? I mean, was this something that just felt like this is where you belonged?
Oh, yes. It was very easy to do. And, you know, I felt very comfortable in front of an audience. I still, you know, find I have a much easier time in front of an audience than I do with just one person.
Is that right?
Yeah, I have trouble, you know, sometimes connecting in my relationships, my personal relationships, and being really honest. I can be very honest in front of a crowd, but I have a hard time just one-on-one.
Well, I do want to play a bit about your mother, who's played such an important part of your comedy. But I want to ask you, though, about your father, because my understanding is that he writes joke books. Now,
yes.
I don't know how his humor is connected to yours. Do you get each other's jokes?
No. Well, he's really like, you know, he's really more of a scholar. Like he compiles material and puts together these joke books for speakers, which are not funny at all. But
oh, you mean like if you want to give a talk and you want to kind of warm the audience, here's
yeah.
a joke you can. Oh my goodness,
that kind of thing, which is just so incredibly dry and boring. And but you know, it's a great thing that he does. And I don't think I really got my sense of humor from him, though. I think I got my discipline and my dedication from him. And I certainly got my sense of humor and my whimsy from my mother.
Did your mom get it? I mean, did she get the humor and again, the fact that one listens to her as kind of channeled through you, uh-huh. one can't help but just love this woman for all her sort of exuberance and...
Yeah.
and
I think that she really loves it, and she really understands it,
right.
you know, and that it's not, you know, that I'm trying to make fun of her or trying to do anything like that. It's just it's a joyous thing, you know. It's just the celebration of who she is, and I think it's really, really good.
As a kid, were you embarrassed about your mother? I mean, I can imagine being maybe 12 or something. I think a lot of girls look at their mothers or look at their parents, and they just wonder, who is this person?
Yeah. I think I was embarrassed by her, but... not as much as I was embarrassed by my father. He really embarrassed me because he was really mean, you know. So he would like be mean to my friends, and it was so scary. So I think that I really, you know, kind of kept people away from my family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the legend of them began with people would never come into my house, and so I would always have to tell them about what happened and what they were doing. And because of that, my parents became like these celebrities, you know, because I kept talking about them, but nobody could come over. You know, and then it was like, is this real? Are they real? And then my parents would suddenly make an appearance. You know, they would bring my lunch to school and other kids would find out that they were, in fact, real. Maybe that's sort of how my early performance started.
Your dad had a temper?
He had a temper. And my mother was just the way she was. Maybe they both embarrassed me. My father was infinitely more embarrassing.
So I'm trying to imagine being, you know, a teenager performing comedy. People begin to notice. And your career begins to take off.
Mm.
Did that take you by surprise? Were you ready for that?
I think I was pretty ready. You know, I worked so hard at it from the very beginning. And I was out there doing open mics and shows every night. Anywhere I could perform, I would try to get a job there. And you know, I was so focused on doing it and so determined to be successful. I think that I didn't have anything else. You know, I really had nothing else in my life besides this dream.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that I was really lucky because I was a really bad student and I was expelled from my high school. And so I disappointed my parents so young that I didn't have the same desire to please them as a lot of other Asian American kids, you know, have. You know, this incredible parental expectations that you need to live up to. I didn't have that over my head. So I could just go and do whatever I wanted. And that gave me this kind of hunger and desperation to really go forward and work. You know, I was very ambitious and you know, it was really like all this dedication that I had to do it. So it didn't surprise me at all that I had achieved this success because I'd envisioned it in my mind all along.
Were you a bad student because you didn't like school, you didn't like the work, it was too hard, it was too easy, it was boring?
I was bored by school, and I was really just not interested. And probably, I think I didn't really like the people I was in school with, that I didn't really bond with any teachers. I just didn't want to be there.
Right.
You know, I felt like there was something else for me.
Were there comedians that you looked at? I mean, and I'm trying to imagine in 15 years ago, Asian American, Korean American comedians that you might see on TV. I mean, was there anybody there that you identified with, or did that not matter?
No, I don't think that there was anybody there. Although that just encouraged me. You know, I felt like, well, there's got to be somebody. So I would just, you know, live on that.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, there were comedians that I was very influenced by when I was starting. People like Richard Pryor, very influential. I really love his work. And also Eddie Murphy, who's great. There are a lot of people that I draw inspiration from that aren't necessarily comedians, people like Barbara Streisand and Judy Garland and, you know, Bette Midler. I really love all of them, and they really have inspired me a lot over the years.
Do you watch them, too? Because those are consummate performers. Do you watch them to sort of see how to be on stage?
Yeah.
And so much of comedy is about timing and, and some of those subtle things that happen.
Yeah, and this cadence and this, you know, ability to draw people to you. It's a power. It's an internal power that they all have that I've really learned by watching and cultivated my own. I don't know. It's an ongoing process.
A lot of comedians say, or some comedians say, that when they're performing, that's when they feel, and you kind of made reference to this, that's when they feel like they really can say what they want to say, that this is a platform which allows them to be as honest as they possibly can. Is that how you see comedy?
Yeah, I
think
yourself? That honesty is really a big part of it. It's truth that I really strive for. And a certain emotional truth that is elusive and hard to get. It's hard to convey. Once you can really get it, then it's really, I think it's really beautiful. And you can really make people really happy, because it's not just about laughing. It's just about this recognition and identifying. And it's a very exciting thing. So I like performing because I like that connection. And it's a part of me that I can't really access in daily life. People are sometimes surprised when they meet me because I'm pretty low-key and kind of shy. But, you know, when I'm on stage, I feel like that person is perfect. Like, I can do anything. And I'm like, I wish I was her. But I'm not. I'm like, really not.
Right.
But I can only get there if I'm up there. So,
I mean, did you watch yourself kind of transform yourself then from the shyer, more private Margaret Cho to the much more explosive
the legend?
Yes. The, no. As you said, the slutty Margaret Cho.
I just feel very comfortable up there. You know, I have so much experience and so much time in this career already that I'm really proud of what I've become up there. Yeah, I've watched myself grow as a performer.
And, you like you up there?
I mean,
you like who you are up there.
It's great.
On stage. Do you carefully write everything out and carefully practice everything before a performance, or do you allow for certain kind of looseness and spontaneity?
There is a sort of improvisational approach at times. There are things that are challenging to say, like the words and the rhythm of it is challenging, so I might try to practice just saying them. But, you know, really, it's a pretty spontaneous thing. And doing stand-up is it's like a living, breathing work of art, so it's you're always working on it somehow.
Do you have rituals before you go on, or you just go on? I know,
no.
Because sometimes it's kind of like an individual sport.
Yeah.
Athletes have these little ritualistic things that they do to get themselves into the mood. Do you do any of that?
I do a lot of reading, which is like a very, I think it's just, I have a really, like a weird ability to concentrate before a show. And, I just find that that's a really good time for me to read.
Like super, super, super concentration. I mean, it's like,
yeah,
laser concentration.
So it's a good time to be focused on something. I don't know. I don't really have a ritual other than that. I don't have that.
That was my interview with comedian Margaret Cho, recorded 15 years ago. Cho embarks on a worldwide tour this fall. You're listening to our stand-up comedy edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. When we get back from our break, we'll hear from veteran comic Colin Quinn. Stay with us. Welcome back to the stand-up comedy edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us. We now turn to my conversation with comedian and actor Colin Quinn. You can see him playing Amy Schumer's father in the film Trainwreck and in his many appearances on the hit HBO show Girls. He's a Saturday Night Live veteran and joined me a few years ago when he was on tour with his play, Long Story Short. He described it as a stand-up play where he used his signature use of plain speak to discuss politics. Let's take a listen.
Are you, though, a history buff?
No. I mean, I like history as much as far as it goes, but I'm not some history buff.
I mean, I've been as far as it goes, right.
I've been in Philly, as far as it goes, my lifetime. And I mean, I've been to Philly like 10 times in my life. I've never been to Independence Hall yet.
Well,
so.
You're very close, just
I
so
know,
you know.
I was going to say, so I'm obviously not a history buff. Yeah,
I think
but
you're an evolution buff.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. I think it's kind of interesting to see that history, you know, what doesn't change. I'm more like into behavioral like stuff. I'm more into like humanity. Like I'm more of a buff of like human behavior and stuff. And how it doesn't, you know.
And the idea that you can do the same thing over and over and over again, expecting different results. Right?
Exactly. And yet have all these technological breakthroughs, but human nature never changes for a second. You know what I mean? That it really doesn't change. That we're still in the same. I mean, we've just, every war, like if you read the Old Testament, it sounds like today.
In fact, you say, and I guess we shouldn't be surprised, that with evolution, it's the survival of the fittest. So it's
right.
It's the tough guys.
Right.
Gals,
it's the tough guys.
That survive.
Well, like we're talking about the whole Arab Spring, the unfortunately named Arab Spring, as tanks roll over. People are like, oh, spring is in the air. Mm. And, you know, the fact is, like, what's going to happen whenever anarchy reigns, everyone's like, well, you know, this is when democracy starts. Guess what? Anytime anarchy's in a place, democracy's not what ends up there. It's never anything.
It just doesn't work out that way.
There's never anything good that ends up where you're like, hey, people are finally free in the streets. It's like France, I mean, French Revolution, you know what I mean?
Do you get nervous before performing?
Yeah, a little bit, but not really. I mean, I get excited, but I mean, I'm definitely focused before I perform because, you know, and put it this way, if I'm unfocused and I go up there and it starts to get a little like you're like, uh-oh, there's a laugh there that's not there, then I get really, you know, locked in. You have to lock in.
And are there certain things you do before going on stage, especially a stage all by yourself?
No, except feel sad before I go on. It's so funny. I feel like a lot of stand-ups do this, but maybe I'm just the only one, but I feel like a lot of stand-ups, when you're on the road by yourself, mm-hmm. I feel like so sad and like just depressed, and maybe that's instead of being nervous, I feel like so depressed.
Really?
Right before I go on, I just get like this horrible.
Like hopeless depressed?
Yeah, like really miserable for like 5 minutes before I go on.
Like this is not going to work.
No, I don't know why. Just lonely and like, oh, what is this? You know, what am I doing? And you know what I mean? You're not even thinking about the actual show. He's just like depressed in general.
Do you think that's sort of a way of
maybe that's
of getting
what
yourself revved up or something?
Yeah. Well, you just need to, you know, and then I go on and it's fine. And then after the show, I'm happy, you know. But it's like, but before I go on, I always have a really dark mood. I feel it come over me.
You're yawning.
I know. Well, that's just, but I mean, I do feel it come over me, definitely. It's strange.
Yeah. And can you kind of read an audience or let's say you're backstage and about ready to go on. Can you kind of sense what kind of an audience you're going to have out there?
Well, with theater, it's usually a good audience. With comedy, if you hear a bunch of idiots laughing or, like, you hear some guy, you almost can't listen to them because you'll go up there with a predisposed attitude, which is bad, you know? Oh. So, I mean, you know, so you don't want to because then you'll get a resentment. You'll be like, look at these idiots, you know? And you go out there and be like, all right, shut up before you even got to your first joke.
Oh, really?
But it's like sometimes you'll hear one guy at a table that's really drunk or really loud or some girl's yapping and they're drunk and it's like, oh, is this going to be one of these shows? Yeah. So that's why you can't really... You have to go and clean slate everything. You know, you can't go, oh, I got to make sure to cover. I got to make sure to shut her up right up. It's like clean slate and deal with it as it comes, you know, because sometimes it's not like that.
So do you want the audience to learn something or do you want them to be entertained or some version of that?
Yeah, I mean, ideally, I feel like comedy, first goal, you have to be funny. You have to get laughs or you're false advertising, you know. Mm-hmm. Preaching is fun, but if it's not getting laughs, you're not a comedian. But I think ultimately the goal of comedy to me is if you can be funny and still say what you think is important, that's the ultimate dream, you know. Pulling that off is the hard part. But I feel like that's my favorite thing, you know.
Are you, do you think of yourself as a political person, as a libertarian, a liberal, a conservative?
Yeah,
I
don't feel like there's any political party that I would say represents how I feel, but maybe something in the middle. Like I have a thing in the show about how when there's who's more hated than Ralph Nader for trying to start a third party, and how people go, "Hey Ralph, it's democracy, two parties." And so I feel like right now I feel like both parties are doing what they do, which is going to the extremes, not really, you know, missing the big point. The sad thing is, I feel like. both parties miss what's really going on, almost by design, I guess. But it's like, you know, and it's just it seems like a very unsophisticated system, considering how the average person feels. It seems like for the average person's feelings, there's nothing that's very sophisticated about this. And the way people talk, it's really, they're talking. It reminds me of TV, the business I'm in TV, which is people play to the lowest common denominator. When the average person's like, no, I don't like that. That's the best you have. So people will put out a TV show, for example. I go, people don't get this kind of humor. And it's like, yeah, they do. You just don't have the goods. And then I feel that way about the political parties. I'm like, okay, if you don't have answers, don't put it on the people don't know. You know, they get very cynical and show. I'm just showbiz is what I know better. But I'm sure politics is the same. Like, oh, you give the people this. That's what they want. It's like, no, that's all you have to give. Then, you know.
Well, now I'm depressed.
Sorry. And it's a comedy show, by the way.
I am curious about that. Doing stand-up is scary. I don't know if it's still scary for you.
Not scary, but I mean, you know, you get a drunk crowd, it's bad, you know. Yeah. You get a drunk crowd, it's bad. You know, crowds like a certain kind. You know, there's drunk crowds or like certain kinds of crowd, they drunk, usually they want sex material, that's it. You know what I mean? And if you're not just talking, you know, like that kind of stuff, it can, you know. It's so funny, crowds, when you can be talking about anything in stand-up, but when you start talking about sex a little bit.
Yeah, what happens?
The whole audience just gets reverent. Just like, even if they're drunk, they're like, wait a minute.
Oh, they'll start paying attention.
Everybody
huh?
Shut up. This guy's saying something now. Right. Now he's talking. It's so funny. And it's been like that my whole career. And I'm like, I even yell at the crowd. I go, do you see yourselves? And the minute I said that, now you got paying. You want to pay attention.
You sound like a elementary school teacher talking to the
That's
students.
Yeah,
right?
Well, stand-up is like that sometimes. You're like a lion tamer.
But I'm assuming early on in your career, I mean, you had to have been bombing on stage. I mean, until you sort of figure out how to do this stuff.
I was a big bomb. I mean, I bombed. I almost take pride in the fact that I bombed so much my first couple of years. And like I always say, the ones that saved me were the comedians. The comedians were so, like, they told me I was funny. I would have quit the business 10 times.
But the audience didn't think you were funny.
The audience thinks I was funny. I was a comedian's comedian, and in the sense that really, in those days, I was really only a comedian's comedian. And they were just like, the audience just, you know, didn't click with me. But the comedian said, you're crazy. You were born to do this. You're a natural. Wow. You know? But the audience didn't think so.
I can't imagine what it's like to be on stage. I mean, trying to make people laugh, and there's just a kind of a stony silence.
Yeah, I got pretty good at bombing. I mean, people used to say I had that same thing that, like, you know, they used to say this about Johnny Carson, believe it or not, when he was doing The Tonight Show, when his jokes would bomb, he was great at that. And I definitely had it. I was a good bomber. I knew how to bomb and be funny bombing, you know, because I was so used to it, too, you know. Right. So, and they used to always say that, you know, like, everybody used to go, I like watching you bomb, you know. They go, I know it's not fun for you, but you're funny when you bomb, you know.
Which is, I guess, both bombing and then commenting on the fact that you're bombing,
yes,
right?
Yeah. And just being in those uncomfortable moments, you know. And I was totally comfortable in them, of course, because it was becoming like a...
So do you miss bombing on
stage? No, I don't. It was definitely... But I mean, I'll still bomb once in a while, you know, not on purpose. I mean, but if it's a wrong crowd or, you know, you go on late and everyone's drunk, it can happen to anybody.
But you're saying comedians would say to you, Colin Quinn, you're hilarious? I mean, you got to keep doing
when
this?
When I started, yeah. They would encourage me because the audience definitely was not, you know. And I wasn't. I was like, this must be the wrong field for me because I'm not doing good.
But did they give you advice? Or?
No. They just said, you're funny. Do your thing, man. You're a comedian, you know. And I got into the good clubs. And so it was like, you know, it was really, I was only in the business I was, you know, but when I went out and did those gigs, man, I was not good. You know?
So they would maybe call and say, this guy's great, you got to book him.
Right. And then the club would book me and be like, we don't think he's great. And the audience doesn't think he's great either. The comedian's like, you just don't get it.
And who were these comedians that were helping you out?
All of them. I mean, it was just in general, I was really treated very well by all these older comedians at the time, you know.
Like the old guys or the
They weren't old, but they were slightly older than me, you know, maybe a couple of years older than me. And in those days, my voice was even more huskier than it is now because I smoked like 3 packs a day. So I talked like, you know, I mean, I almost sounded like an old mob guy, you know, in front of a social club, you know. And I mean, I really had this deep, I mean, because I smoked all the time. I mean, I was a chain smoker.
Really? Like several packs a day?
Like 3 packs a day, yeah. I mean, if I hadn't quit smoking, I'd be dead. I mean, I'd be dead by now. I quit in like almost 18 years.
Was it hard to give up smoking?
Horrible. It's really hard. But, you know, you get into the fun of quitting. It's not that, you know, it's the dread that makes it worse. You know what I mean? Like, if you just said, this is uncomfortable, I can't believe I'm this miserable over a stupid, a piece of paper with, you know, these leaves in it.
Yeah.
This is my best friend.
Yeah.
And when you realize it's your best friend and you're giving up your best friend, then you can get over it. It's emotional. It's the physical part is a few days, but it's that emotional connection.
Do you miss it? Smoking?
Oh, yeah. Every time I smell cigarettes or I'm in a room when people smoke, like some ex-smokers don't like it, I love it. I want to smoke, you know, but it's like, it doesn't, but I know I'm not going to do it. It's just like, look, this is going to pass in a minute, you know, but I love the way it smells when I smell smoke. I love the smell of smoke.
And you gave up drinking too, right?
That was way before that.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
And you had been a bartender, right?
I was sober bartending my last couple of years of bartending. I quit drinking and I was, that was easier than quitting smoking, but it was still hard, you know.
Well, especially working in a bar, I would think.
Yeah, every time I'd smell Jack Daniels, which was my little drink, I'd be like, ew. Anytime anybody ordered Jack Daniels, that was the only time it was really hard for me. But, you know, it was like I had no choice at that point. It was like I could drink if I wanted to.
Were you an alcoholic?
Oh, yeah. Sure. Why else would I quit drinking?
Yeah.
Drinking's fun, unless you're an alcoholic.
Yeah, exactly. So you were born in Brooklyn, 1959?
Yes.
What kind of family?
You know, Irish Catholic. I mean, you know, middle class. And we were like, I grew up in Park Slope, which is a great neighborhood. Oh, sure. At the time, it was kind of a, you know.
That was pretty kind of shishi, isn't it?
Now it is, yeah. And then it was like a real Brooklyn neighborhood. And that was very, you know, very mixed growing up and very like stickball. We played stickball every day. And we played, you know, stoop ball. And it was like a lot of, you know, there's a lot of. It was kind of a rough, it was considered a rougher neighborhood at the time, you know. It was considered kind of like those gangs and stuff like that. But, you know, it was a lot of, you were in the street all the time. I mean, it was like real Brooklyn, like the last, like we got the last of those, of hanging out in the street and playing ball in the street and just going around. And, you know, you'd be on the subway when you're like 9 years old by yourself and all that stuff. You know, it was like a, now, like, you know, my nieces and nephews, they don't let them near the subway, when they, you know, until they're like 15 or 14 or whatever, you know, it's like. Then we were just, people just didn't worry about it, you know. You'd come in, they'd kick you out of the house till the end, until it was dark, you know. But it was like, yeah.
It's were you a rough kid or just a regular neighborhood kid?
Yeah, I was a regular, I was a loudmouth, you know what I mean? I mean, I wasn't rough. I was like, you know, I wasn't a great fighter. I'd have a few fights, I won a couple, but, you know, nobody's crossing the street to get away from me, you know. Like a lot of the badass kids were, you know. So, I mean, you know, but I mean, I was like, you know, I was like a real, you know, just another kid, but I was a loud one, of course. I was the funny one. I was funny even as a kid, so everybody
really,
was like.
Really, as a little kid?
Yeah. Well, not little, but I mean, say by 12, you know, I was funny by 12. People started going, hey, that guy's funny.
Mm.
Or else, hey, that guy's a big mouth.
Is that same thing, funny and a big mouth?
Yeah, for many people it is. Mm. There's some quiet comedians that are really funny, you know. I mean, Mitch Hedberg was a famous, you know, rest his soul, you know, but he and Stephen Wright, I mean, those guys are like real quiet guys. They're not acting on stage. They're quiet off stage too, but they're funny as anything.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
And it's just a different style, you know, and I never thought there could be such a thing when I was little, you know, like a real funny, quiet guy like that.
Did you go to Catholic school?
No. Public schools.
But public school, yeah. And your parents, I mean, were you one of a bunch of kids or?
Four kids, yeah.
Four kids. And your parents, middle class?
Yeah, teachers and, you know.
But did they encourage your comedy?
Yeah, they I think everyone just knew I was going to do that. You know, it was like, there was no real, you know, it was like, I mean, they didn't discourage, I wouldn't say they thought I would be a comedian necessarily, but I was definitely something like, you know, you realize this guy's got to be in one of those things. You know what I mean? Like, I just had that personality of a comedian, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't think in those days there weren't that many comedians, so to be a comedian would have been weird. Like in the 70s when I was a kid, there was like four comedians that you knew about, you know, four or five. Now by the time I started comedy, it became almost like a doctor and lawyer. Suddenly everybody's doing it. But in the early days, you're like, no, you can't be a comedian, but you'd be like a funny person at something, you know. But they definitely, you know, they never discouraged me and said, you know, you're not. I mean, they laughed at me, you know, it was funny.
So they're a good audience.
Yeah, I was the funny, you know, in my family I was funny, in the street I was funny, at school. Yeah. The teachers didn't care
for me. Well, I was going to say, I was one, because sometimes those funny kids are the ones in the back.
Yes, I was that kid. That
sitting in detention somewhere.
Yeah, I was always the kid that was, if I wasn't cutting out of school and getting in trouble, I was always the loud mouth that the teachers didn't like because I would make everybody laugh. But it's like, you know, because I was bored. You know, I was bored. I think a lot of comedians have ADD, you know.
It's interesting you say that because I was watching your HBO A Long Story Short. Mm-hmm. And just the sort of antsy, you know, your antsiness.
I'm antsy.
Yeah. And even, I mean, you're antsy.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I have ADD very badly, but, you know.
Well, maybe it works for your comedy.
Yeah. I think it gets in the way, too, sometimes. But, yeah. I mean, it's hard to focus. But, you know, even with stand-up, maybe that's why I was bombing all those times. That only comedians could hear me. You know what I mean? Because they all have ADD. So they're like, hey, don't you get it? He just switched subjects. And people are like, what's he doing? We just had a drink and a half. We don't want to switch subject in the middle of the statement.
And there are a lot of digressions in this long story short, I have to say.
Yeah, well, and believe me, that's me at my most focused.
and did you cut school a lot? I mean, were you?
Yeah, I was like, I was, you know. I was
were you
like,
truant or?
I was almost a truant. I mean, I was as close to a truant as you could get, I would say. You know what I mean? I mean, I just, yeah.
Where would you go?
I would go to just walk around the streets, walk around the park, smoke pot, go to the train stations, you know, shoot pool once in a while, you know. And, yeah, just anywhere but school I would go, you know, just go to somebody's house. But mostly just on the trains, going to, you know, because it was, you know, it was New York. I mean, sure. It was Brooklyn, but it was like fun, man, just going around places. You know, you'd find somebody else who wanted to get in trouble that day, you know, just travel around in people's neighborhoods, you know.
Did you finish high school?
Yes, but it took a little longer. Yeah. I took a little longer than, yeah. It's interesting you ask me that because, you know, you think anybody can finish high school, but like even I heard Ellen DeGeneres didn't finish high school. I was like, that's a comedian's mind because she seems like she'd be the good student.
Yes.
She didn't finish high school. So it's like comedians just, you know, they either go to law school. Like some comedians go to law school, like they really are either good students or they're just really bad students. It's like nobody in the middle.
And that was my 2011 interview with comedian and actor Colin Quinn, who can be currently seen in Amy Schumer's new film, Trainwreck. You're listening to our comedy-centric edition of Radio Times in Review. When we get back from our break, we'll hear from Mike Birbiglia about his sleepwalking disorder and his comedy career. Stay with us. Welcome back to the stand-up comedy edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. We'll now take a listen to my interview with comedian Mike Birbiglia, who's also a contributor to This American Life. He made a name for himself when he began mining his sleepwalking disorder for comic material. When he joined me, he was touring with an act that centered around his peculiar and nearly fatal behavior that took place while he was sleeping. He later turned his routine into a critically acclaimed film, Sleepwalk With Me. Let's take a listen to my 2008 interview with Mike Birbiglia about his life, his work, and his sleep. Tell us a little bit about this disorder that you have from your perspective. What is it like to be you with this disorder?
Well, it's a disorder that I'd had for many years, but I never quite dealt with. I would have these incidents like the Dustbuster Olympics, or for example.
And that's for real, right?
Oh, yeah. No, and beyond real. I wish it weren't. I would have a dream, for example, where there was a hovering insect-like jackal in my bedroom, which is the scariest animal one's brain can conjure, is a jackal that defies gravity, and I would jump on the bed. I would strike a karate pose, and I would say, "There's a jackal in the room," to my girlfriend at the time, and she would say, "There's no jackal, go to bed." And I would say, "Are you sure?" She'd say, "Yes, there's no jackal," and I would go to bed knowing that there was a jackal right there. And at that point, you know, and with the Dustbuster Olympics, I was thinking, you know, maybe I should see a doctor. This seems dangerous. And then I thought, maybe I'll eat dinner. And I just went with dinner. For years.
Put off seeing the doctor.
Yeah.
But from your experience and just those two vivid examples, we should say to our listeners, you're asleep at this time while all this is going on.
Completely asleep.
On the one hand, you have these amazingly vivid dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess on the other hand, and this is part of this disorder, is you begin to act out those dreams. They seem real to you.
And the physical elements of this are that you're having a dopamine deficiency. Dopamine is the chemical that's released from your brain into your body when you fall asleep that paralyzes your body so that you don't do what's in your brain, essentially. And so if people who have this can act out their dreams, and people, in rare instances, people who have this have been known to kill the person they're in bed with while remaining asleep. So in other words, they'd have a dream that it was some kind of burglar or something, and they would take a bat, they would beat the burglar to death. They wake up, it's not the man's it's not a burglar, it's the man's wife, and she's dead. I read this. I remember reading this because there's an excellent book called The Promise of Sleep out there, written by a guy named Dr. Dement, and it talks all about, which is a very unfortunate name for a man trying to instill calm.
Dr. Dement, yes.
He might have been opted for a pseudonym, but it's an excellent book. And I was reading that in rare instances, people are known to kill people in their sleep. And I read this, and I still didn't see a doctor. Because I was so busy. That was all. It's always been my excuse for whenever I don't want to deal with something in my life, I always point out how busy I am.
Well, of course. I tell people,
they don't. In my mind, it makes sense. I'm like, this person doesn't realize how busy I am. If they knew, of course they wouldn't want me to see a doctor.
Well, you had mentioned something earlier. I mean, this. Have you had sleep problems your whole life, and it's sort of gravitated into this pretty serious disorder?
Yeah. I never had sleepwalking as a kid, although that's very common in children. But I always had wild dreams. Like,
did
as
you?
A kid, I always had dreams that there was a bear walking in the front door of my house. That was a recurring dream of literally opening the door, which is the scariest part, a bear with opposable thumbs.
Indeed.
As if a bear can open a door, sky's the
Stephen
limit.
Stephen Colbert would agree with
that's
you
right.
with that.
There was actually a story in the news this week about a bear that actually did open a door.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's actually the most terrifying thing one can imagine.
But that was a recurring dream that you had as a kid?
As a kid, yeah.
But you didn't sort of fight the bear or do anything like that. So this came later in life, this sort of acting out.
It happened in my early 20s. I was experiencing a tremendous amount of anxiety because I was living with my girlfriend at the time, and it became very clear that she wanted to get married. And I was 23, and I wasn't ready to get married, but I couldn't say it.
Yeah.
But I started having trouble breathing. I would have that shallow breathing, where you feel like you can't breathe, and then you feel like you're going to die because breathing is one of the building blocks of living, And I started sleepwalking, and that's when I started having these incidents.
Wow.
Yeah.
And do you still have the same girlfriend?
Nope. she met someone else. And
well, as you say, your stand-up is about a number of things, including the sleep problem that you have, but also about denial.
Mm-hmm.
I think we can all relate to some aspect of denial. But
by
at some
all
point,
means.
You did seek therapy. I mean, you read this book by Dr. Dement, The Promise of Sleep, and it sounds like he told you some of the sort of basic architecture of sleep and sleep hygiene as it's described.
Yeah, there's a few basic things you can do that for healthier sleep, and this goes for people who have sleep disorders
sure.
or not. I was talking to my mom about this last night. I mean, my dad was up late watching like a violent like mystery show or something, and it's actually so counterintuitive to do that. He talks about turning off the news before you go to bed, turning off your phone, turning off the internet, not having big meals, like anything that would kind of stimulate mm-hmm. you. I mean, a few hours before bed, you should theoretically try and kind of dial down.
All right. And that's what you've learned to do.
Yeah.
Did you ever have sort of sleep phobia? I mean, sort of knowing that you could have some wild night on your hands that you sort of had that sort of phobic feeling about your bed?
Absolutely. I mean, like, I tour as a comedian. That's my full-time job. And so it's tough because for a while I wouldn't talk about it because I was ashamed of this kind of crazy disorder that I had. And so my agent would actually call ahead to places I was performing and say, Mike has to stay on the first floor because I'd had a dangerous incident where I actually jumped out of a window from the second floor. And inevitably they'd ask.
In your sleep, obviously.
Yeah, in my sleep. And inevitably they'd ask why. And he'd cover for me. He'd be like, because that's what Mike Birbiglia wants, And I'd show up and these people would kind of vaguely dislike me before I'd even met them because I had these absurd requests. And it started to feel this kind of slight distance between me and everyone that I met. And it was very sad.
But, it's interesting, and I think a lot of comedians do this, which is to take either shameful or painful parts of their life and you know, turn them around or find the comedy in it. And I always think that there's comedy and tragedy are pretty closely aligned. There's almost like a flip side of each other.
Oh, yeah, there's a very fine line.
Depending on one's perspective, I think.
Absolutely. I think the closer you go to the truth, the closer you can get to comedy. And
that's
I'm
funny.
Still working on that. I'm still riding that line, trying to figure out exactly where that is. But yeah, no, it's all my stories are true. I always have to preface my show by saying that because inevitably someone will come up to me after the show and they'll be like, was that true? And I'm like, yeah. And they're like, was it? And I don't know how to respond to that. Like, I guess I could say it louder.
Prove it, right?
Yeah, yeah. I could be like, yeah. And they'd be like, it's probably true. He said it louder. But no, it's true. I mean, it's just one of these rare instances in your life where in retrospect you're like, what the hell? And at the time you're like, I guess I'll continue living. I don't know. It's like if you went to the dentist and he asked you to take your pants off and you're like, he's got a degree. I don't know. But I'm going to make a note of this because this seems crazy.
Well, let me talk a little bit about you.
Sure.
And I read that you went to Georgetown University. You studied writing there?
Yep.
And you also won the Funniest Student Award in college? The
yeah,
Funniest
that,
Person on
that's
Campus
That's why I started
award?
Being a comedian.
Is
yeah.
that right?
Yeah, I'd always wanted to be a comedian, but I've heard this a lot from people where it's a contest of some kind that kind of gets you to say, you know what, I'm going to go for that. And I won, and then I ended up working at the door of the D.C. Improv. I got to open one of the prizes was to open for Dave Chappelle at the D.C. Improv.
For this Dave Chappelle?
Yeah, this was very pre his Comedy Central series fame and all that stuff, but I was a big fan of his stand-up, and so it was a big honor, and then I said I'd like to get on stage again, and they handed me a mop, and so I had a job just kind of working the door and selling tickets and doing all these kinds of things. And I actually, you know, it was kind of my education in comedy was working at this club and watching these great national headliners who would come in, you know, Brian Regan and Mitch Hedberg and Louis Black and Dave Attell and these kind of folks. And and I learned that you can make a living being a comedian.
But you have to be funny. I mean, clearly you were.
Yeah, you have to be more than funny. I mean, you have to, there's a lot of hardship. any kind of making a living being an artist, I feel like there's a lot of delusion that has to be there where because there's a lot of failure
of course
at the outset, and you have to tell yourself it's going well when it's clearly not going well. You know, like I remember my first gig was completely based on a lie. My first paid gig, I was asked to perform 30 minutes at a place called Fat Tuesdays in Virginia, and what I should have said was I probably only have about 11 minutes prepared, and what I did say was yeah. And I show up and I'm backstage, which is just like the sidewalk of a strip mall, and I'm scared to death because I don't know what's going to happen after the 11 minutes. And they opened the
door.
You
knew you had 11, and you knew you had to fill
30. And I had no idea what was going to happen. And
so
what
happened?
I even said to the guy who was the headliner, I go, hey, what happens if I run out of material? And he goes, just make fun of people. I was like, I don't know if that's such a good idea. Because whenever I make fun of people, they punch me in the face. You know, I later found out that's a whole genre of
it
comedy.
Is.
You know,
the sort
people,
of hostility comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
Stuff.
You know, people walk up on stage and nice shirt, loser. Everyone's like, it's so true. His shirt does suck. This guy's a genius. I'm from Jersey.
Right. Not your style, right?
It's not my forte. And but they open the door and they go, Mike, you're on. I turn around and I throw up on the sidewalk. And then, because my body couldn't come up with another plan, it was just like, what do we do? Let's get rid of some food, you know. And I walked on stage, and I heard them say, I've heard many bastardizations of my last name in my life. This is the worst I'd heard.
What was it?
Please welcome Mike Bahuski. I was like, so mad. I was like, you didn't even try. You just said B and then whatever you could think of. And I did 4 minutes of comedy, because when you're bombing, it pairs down very quickly.
You're just jettisoning things, or you're just going so fast?
Yeah,
kind of
fast, and then basically, you know, tags of jokes fall away when the original punchline doesn't work. So the kind of the digressions and riffs go
So what did you do
away.
For 26 minutes?
I just walked off. I said, thank you, sorry. You know, I walked off. I thanked people and apologized at the same time. And then I drove home to my girlfriend at the time, and she said, how'd it go? And I said, it was amazing. Because in my mind, it had been, and if it hadn't, I wouldn't have been on stage ever again. I wouldn't have done it again.
So this ability to delude oneself or be in denial,
denial,
as you say,
yeah,
But clearly you had to, figure out some stuff, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think, like any art form, it just takes a lot of trial and error. I mean, I get so many MySpace messages and Facebook messages and emails from people saying, I want to be a comedian. How do I do it? And there is no answer for that. And that's a difficult thing because there's a lot of people who want to become comedians and they're very funny. A lot of these people are the funniest people you could ever imagine. I mean, my brother Joe, who collaborates with me on a lot of writing, attempted to be a comedian early on, and he just couldn't – he didn't enjoy the rejection or couldn't handle the rejection enough, and there's so much of it. So he just was like, oh, I'd prefer to be a writer.
But does it help – I mean, are you sticking to a script, or do you allow yourself some spontaneity?
Early on, I really stuck to a script. I mean, word for word. I mean, in shows I do now, it's I feel more comfortable being loose about it. But yeah, I mean, there's a great interview with Jerry Seinfeld available somewhere that said, I think it's called Jerry Seinfeld on Comedy, and they ask him what advice he has for young comedians, and he says, every year there's a conference in Las Vegas where these comedians come and they do workshops and classes and all these things to find out how to become a comedian. And he said, I would cancel all of those and I would just put up a sign that says, go home and work. And it's like, that's all you can do is just work and fail and work and fail, and eventually you work and succeed.
And is it just mining your life, or are you one of those people that sort of is a sponge? You know, when you're out in the world, you're kind of a sponge. You're hearing conversations or seeing situations.
I suppose I am. Yeah, I guess that's where it comes from.
You've kept while you've been doing this tour, you kept a kind of a journal on some of the experiences that you have, and you have a really funny description of doing the show where Chris Matthews is actually in the very front row while you're doing your comedy tour. I wonder if you could talk about that.
I actually, that wasn't on this specific tour, but I write a blog. It's called mysecretpublicjournal.com. Right. And I'm always a little embarrassed to tell people I have a blog because everyone has a blog about anything. People will be like, today I went to JCPenney, and there's like, one comment, like, JCPenney, eh? I'm like, that's not a blog. That's a text message.
Yes,
but no, I actually do spend quite a bit of time on writing my blog, and I email it to thousands of people who get it. And I think it actually, even people who sign up for it, it goes into their spam box. I found this
Such
out.
Such is the way of the internet.
I found
right?
this out because I go into my own spam box, yeah. Which is insane.
It tells us something about you, but nonetheless,
right, exactly.
Tell us this story about Chris Matthews.
No, so I was asked to do a roast of Stiller and Mira, the comedy duo, classic comedy duo, and in Nantucket. They had a Nantucket Comedy Festival, and Chris Matthews was in the front row, and I said, I love your because actually my wife and I watch his show every day. We watch Hardball, and I said, I love your show, Chris. I love it almost as much as you do. I don't even recall what it was that I had like about four jokes back to back.
You said I even watch your weekend show.
Oh, I go, yeah, I even watch your weekend show on NBC that no one watches, and and he goes, people do watch that. I'll show you the numbers. And then he threw a bottle at me, and it was a plastic bottle, so it was non-threatening. But I said, Chris, when you throw stuff, I win. That's how it works. And
did you have the last laugh?
I think so. Yeah, people applauded and cheered, and but the truth is, if he had had a microphone, he actually is very funny. I had met him earlier in the day, and if he had had a microphone, he possibly. I may well have been toast.
That was comedian and This American Life contributor Mike Birbiglia, who joined me in studio in 2008. And that wraps up the stand-up comedy edition of Radio Times in Review. Tell us what you think of the show. Send us an email, whyy.org/Radio Times. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.